Welcome to Packet Pushers, the data networking podcast where real engineers get together to talk nerdy, a place where we can talk so fast that you can't even hear what we're saying because we use multiple synchronous lanes for conversation using an asynchronous overlay. Of course, you are excited. When real engineers get together to talk nerdy, we don't have to apologize for being technical, for waving our hands at virtual whiteboards, and generally pretending that we know what networking is all about. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. Today is another community show where we continue on with the discussion on the silicon inside your network device, part three. In an amazing outburst of creativity, we've had two shows where we've actually talked about what actually happens inside your network hardware. We've talked about things like CPUs, memory modules, the types of boxes, whether they're 1RU or centralized or distributed. Talked about packet processing engines, forwarding options, how a packet moves through the packet walk, and the types of technologies like FPGAs and network processors and ASICs that do all of the actual packet forwarding inside of the switch itself. We've talked about route lookups, packet buffers, forwarding features, how so many ports work. Today, we're now going to start talking about even more complex issues around buses, chassis, and hardware knowledge in the real world. They're the three topics that we've got. So hopefully, we've got enough content for at least an hour, and I'm sure we can go longer, but I think we'll probably wrap it up today. So joining me today, once again, is Simon Chatterjee. Simon, say hello to the audience.
Hi guys, my name's Simon Chatterjee. Thanks, Greg. I've been building routers and switches for about 15 years now. Worked on quite a few successful products, particularly towards the high-end multi-terabit router product families.
Thanks very much for your time, because I know that you are deeply involved in the big stuff, and so it's really good to have your knowledge around. And once again today is John Harrington. Hi, John. What's happening with you?
Hey, Greg. How are you doing? I'm blogging at thenetworksherpa.com, and I'm on at Network Sherpa on Twitter. I think I was saying the last time I'm looking at this from a user perspective and have a disturbing interest in hard things hardware.
It's like an itch you can't scratch, isn't it? You look at a networking box and then you open up the lid and it's not like an x86 server and you see CPU, north bus, south bus, network adapters, power supply. It's all pretty obvious, isn't it? But a networking device is always different every time you poke around inside.
Oh, yeah, it's getting sucked down the rabbit hole. You think, oh, here's this one thing. I'll just have a quick look at this and see if I can understand it. And then it leads you on to five other technologies, which leads you on to five other technologies. And, yeah, pretty soon you've lost your week, month, year, whatever,
There's one thing that happened to me this week that I wanted to talk to you about, John, because you posted a blog post about a year ago, I think, on cleaning fiber, which had a YouTube video in it. And I'll try and put a link into that from your blog to this, but a lot of people don't realize that cleaning fiber is really important. You've got a lot to say about that, haven't you?
Yeah, well, I guess I support a lab, and I guess a lab would be a fairly hostile environment for fiber. We do our best to kind of maintain fiber paths and some decent standards. But I hadn't realized it before I started my current job, but I've been working with multi-mode, single-mode fiber for a little bit now. And yeah, you just got to clean it. Every time you touch a fiber, you've got to clean it. And I know guys coming from maybe the telco or transport side, you told them you inserted the single-mode fiber without cleaning it, they'd have your head. But yeah, I mean, if you don't know, basically most of the time you've got CRC errors on a fiber-backed link. It's either damage to the fiber or, most of the time just dust or dirt either, on the end of your connector or in the housing. So, it's important. It's really important. And it's pretty easy as well. You got to, but if you've got technicians on site or if you've got a tool bag, you need to have a fiber cleaner in it. And if you don't, because they're nasty errors as well. It's this thing, the type of gray failure that kills network engineers. We've got this low level of, 2-3% packet loss. You don't know why, but it's hitting everything, and of course the network is at fault.
And it can be in just one direction, which makes it harder, because it's going to be on the transmit or the receive.
That's right, yeah.
And it doesn't always show up on the Ethernet interface. So when you do show interface, blah blah blah, it doesn't show up as errors because it sometimes doesn't get decoded off the fire chip.
Yeah, I mean, you can have different levels of errors. Some of it is being corrected for you, and you're leading to, discards, etc. But yeah, I mean, generally, look, if you've got any suspicions at all, look at your power levels, look at your CRCs. Generally, they're shown there. And even if you don't have any idea what's wrong and you have a suspect link, clean the fiber. That's the answer to everything. You know, clean the fiber.
I'm actually thinking about publishing like a little book for $2, which talks about how fiber works, right? This concept of power sum, you know, and how the fiber optic does all its thing. I think I could write about 5,000 words on how a fiber optic works so that people could realize just how important it is to clean the fiber and why it's such a, because basically you've usually got about 20 dBs of power in a fiber optic signal. When it launches from the transmit laser, you can lose 20 dB of signal, which is an astonishing amount, right? Because normally across a connector, you lose maybe half a dB or 0.3 of a dB. Yeah, that's a bad connector. That's not a good one. That's a bad one. And so for most people inside a data center, you never get to burn up 20 dBs of loss, and then the signal degrades to a failure point. The cable's got to lose 20 dB. And I mean, in the worst case, the best case, which is you've got a lot of launch power and a very sensitive receiver, it can even be up to 30 dB or 35, which means the signal can attenuate 30 times because it's a logarithmic scale of decibel. I think it's 30 times. Is that right, Simon?
It's logarithmic, yeah.
Yeah. So you've sort of got all this signal that you've got to lose before the actual fiber optic cable just says, I'm not getting enough signal, go take it down. And that's where the problem comes in. And dirty fiber is far more likely than failed fiber in some situations.
Yeah, failed is easy. Generally, failed is an easy one to.
Yeah.
Dirty, degraded, bent, and mishandled fiber. That's the one.
Yeah, the one you walk on every day as you go past the rack.
The one somebody cable tied neatly with to an inch of its life to your rack. That's the one.
You can see it's either cable tie and the actual plastic is deforming around the cable tie. It's probably
you got to make it tight. You know, you can't take any chances.
Yeah, the cable might escape. It might break for freedom.
Yeah. Well, one tip on this that's actually maybe even on topic, which is the physical coding sublayer of the Ethernet standards changed for 10 gig and up, so that to detect this kind of dirty error. As John says, CRCs are a great measure, but obviously if you're not sending that many packets, there won't be that many CRCs to fail. And so for a 10 gig and up encoding, if you're basically saturating the fiber, then the CRCs will tell you a lot about the quality, but the symbol error faults will tell you almost nothing. And for almost empty fiber, it's the opposite way around. The CRCs will tell you very little, but the symbol errors will tell you everything that the silicon will tell you. So it's worth looking at both if you know the packet isn't, if the fiber isn't necessarily saturated, because the errors might be picked up either the CRC error or the symbol errors.
I have this theory that 80% of network faults are caused by physical cabling, and what I mean by that is there's faults that happen because of things failing. But if I have to choose between a cable failure and a chip failure, I'll always go with a cable failure every day of the week. Because it's usually the cable that fails, not the device. It's far more common.
Yeah, and that extends in big provider networks as well. Again, it's far more likely to get a fiber cut or problem, as you say, rather than a line card die or a router just explode. It's much more likely to be the link.
Well, simple things too, like, you know, if you've got a big hole in the ground where the whole bunch of fiber is, as the hole in the ground gets hot and cold, the cable stretches and shrinks. And that causes mechanical stress on the cable and the joins in the cable. And if the installation is not absolutely perfect, that, you know, they've got stress release and cable winds and, you know, all this sort of stuff, or a lot of fiber optic cable has a Kevlar core, and that Kevlar core sometimes, depends on the cable type, has to be tied off so that it's stressed correctly or locked in place, if you like. And if those aren't done, you can find that cable degrades. I mean, you can't do anything about these. You just have to assume that the cable's faulty, of course, but anyway, it's more complicated than it looks, as I've found out to my chagrin over the years. So let's move the discussion on into back to talking about the hardware that's inside of your silicon, with a discussion around the chassis. So there are usually, when we talk about a chassis switch, we're talking about something that has multiple line cards. So instead of being, you know, and 48 ports, and there's 8 or 10 or 12, or, you know, in some of the more behemoth switches, 18 or 20. So companies like Huawei and Cisco have 18 slot and 20 slot chassis. So let's talk a little bit about how they work. So Simon, do you want to kick us off there? We're talking about the buses in the back.
Yeah. So if you go really back to you know, like early mid 90s when routers were really kind of just souped up Unix workstations or PCs, then you would literally have a shared bus on the back joining the line cards, you know, a parallel set of copper paths where one line card at a time could assert high or low voltages to send ones and zeros. And so, which was kind of how you built computers at the time, but that very quickly becomes just this massive bottleneck, the system, because only one line card can be sending one packet at one time to another line card. And so you very quickly got to the stage where you need something better. You want every line card to be sending packets into the back and getting packets out from the back all at the same time. So you need something fancier than just a kind of effectively the router version of a shared coax linking up the line cards around the back. So the main answer to that is a switch fabric. So a switch fabric is an active piece of silicon. There's silicon on every line card, there's silicon centrally, either on the RAT processor cards themselves or in some other set of cards that are usually redundant and upgradable. But their goal there is to give you the magic. So every line card can be talking to every other line card at the same time, so you get a non-blocking path through the back. Mm. Now, to do that, obviously, you need to be kind of clever. So it's an imperfect analogy is with speed dating. So if you imagine, you know, all the line cards turn up for a speed date, and they're interested in some subset of the other line cards that they're like, look off, meaning those line cards for which at that moment in time they have packets queued up and ready to send. So if they had the opportunity to send a packet over the back plane, you know, maybe line card one has packets queued up ready for line cards two and three, but doesn't care about three and four. So with a switch fabric, you kind of, you know, imagine the host of the speed dating party and gets in notes from everyone about who they fancy. And then if they got an opportunity to give, you know, one kiss in, they would do a global optimization process to try to get as many sort of exchanges going on in that one time as possible. And then you kind of throw it away and start again with the new information. So every fabric cycle, the line cards will tell the central scheduler which line cards they have packets ready for. And the scheduler will try and get you know, as many exchanges to go as possible. So it'll set it up, it'll set up maybe line card, in a moment you can speak to line card two you can speak to line card seven, sorry, you're out, this go. And then just set up its internal plumbing in the central silicon, and then boom, without any buffering, that packet goes across the back plane to the destination and over, and then you do the whole thing all over again for the next set of packets because the buffers have changed. So that's the kind of core idea. Obviously, there's quite a few things that strike you about that, even at this kind of naive level. One is, if you had a really big packet, that would hold up everything for everyone. So you tend to fragment down to some, you know, historically, maybe 100 bytes thereabouts, so that big packets don't get an unfair impact on the whole scheduling. And obviously, you need to get fairness. It could be that the scheduler is, you know, just through chance, you never let line card one send to line card two for a long period of time, even though it's ready to do that in trying to get as much throughput. So there's not normally some built-in fairness, which is really just kind of this rotating clock every cycle. It'll sort of prefer a different line card to go if there's an equal choice. But with those two things, that's kind of the core idea of a switch fabric. And they get obviously pretty fancy. You can do built-in multicast, you can do all kinds of things, but that's the core idea.
Okay, so let's just try and recap that. The early chassis had a bus, literally looked like an Ethernet bus, and you transmitted something onto the bus and all the modules would hear it, and then the one who was the destination would take it off. And that was sort of like back in the late 90s. That was like the Bay Networks BN5000, the CAT 5500 of its era, and so forth. That's a fair summary?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Yeah, we don't do that today because bus fabrics are not dense enough. They're not fast enough. And obviously, when you send something on a bus, you've got blocking problems. So we pretty much abandoned those in the late 90s and moved to the earliest chassis that I remember went to multiple buses. So the later generations had multiple. So like the BN5000 had multiple Ethernet buses in the back. So I think it had 10, three token rings and a couple of FIDI buses in the back. But that didn't sort of last long enough as the bandwidth increased. As the number of modules increased, the number of interfaces increased, you needed more backplane bandwidth to connect the line cards. So if you had more and more line cards with more and more 100 megs and more 1 gigs and 48 gigs, 10 gigs, you need enough bandwidth on the backplane to connect them all together. So they moved to a crossbar, which means each line card has an I/O channel to talk down to a fabric, a switch fabric. Now, We talked about switch fabrics in the earlier shows, but I've also written a blog post about the switch fabrics and how it works and what it is, which has got a whole bunch. It's actually a 6-post series, which I'll add as a link in the show notes. But a switch fabric is a chip that allows all of the line cards to talk to all the other line cards almost simultaneously at the same time. Each packet can be sent. And that's what you're talking about there with that crossbar, or the switch fabric in the back allows all the modules to talk to all the other modules. Is that correct?
That's exactly right, yeah.
So that's the crossbar design that we have today. So every line card has a channel going down the backplane. Oh, and when we talk about the connector down the backplane, we're just talking about literally pieces of copper or something on a baseboard, on a thing, isn't it? It's just copper.
Yeah, in almost all cases, that's right, yeah. Mm. As John said in an earlier show, I mean, it's a surprisingly hostile environment. You're trying to send ones and zeros really quickly down a bit of copper glued to some fiberglass. So even just, you try to make the backplane to be entirely passive without any active things, so it doesn't go wrong. So you only have to upgrade line cards and power supplies and never rip out the whole chassis. But even so, there's a surprising amount of technology just in making copper glued to fiberglass be able to sustain really high throughputs.
Yeah, passive backplanes that aren't. I love that. Have you, yeah. John, you've probably seen that, passive backplanes that actually aren't very passive.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, you're trusting they'll do the right thing. Yeah, I mean, you've seen in the 6500E, I remember that was, it's a little while ago now at this stage, but I remember the explanation being given at the time, you know, there was all these copper traces on the back plane, and I didn't know what the hell a copper trace was at that point in time, but they're saying, you know, we want to be able to go to a higher speed at some point, or you want to take advantage of the next generation of fabric and line cards, and even the passive backplane, the copper trace is laid at the back. One capable of supporting sufficient signal density, and thus we need to upgrade, because 6500E was power, but also copper traces as well. So it's to make it more capable of handling these speeds, you know. So,
Well, then you've got to put a little signal down a little tiny piece of copper, and you've got to clock it at, I'm trying to remember what the backplane speed of a 6500 was, 40 gigs, I think, towards the end. I think it was today it's 80 gigabits. You're trying to get an 80 gigabit per second signal down a little piece of copper. Now, keep in mind that an 80 gigabit signal, what does it run today? It's not, it's a 55, 56 encoding. Simon, you might be better for this. I can't remember off the top of my head.
Well, the encoding used on the backplane is normally proprietary.
Yeah.
Any given sort of differential pair will carry some number of, you know, maybe teens of gigabits per second, or low single digits of gigabits per second, depending on the speed of thing. So you need multiple parallel lanes, but yeah, you encode them, you do all kinds of crazy things to sort of persuade the signal to go out the wire and then recover it on the other end.
And this is all physical magic, you know, waveforms and current flows and all this sort of stuff. It's not just send a signal and it comes out the other end like we do with Ethernet.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, if you just think of think to your high school physics, when you're sending, you know, bits this fast, then things like even the speed of the light down the copper, and it doesn't take very many centimeters of deviation between two paths before you get a whole bit out in just the speed of light traveling down the copper. So, you know, we're sending bits so fast that they're less like, you know, light switches and more like leaky, you know, it's almost radio going over the fiberglass.
Yes, and very, as you said, differential signaling. They actually send the signal down two channels and add them back together, and then they can work out what the noise is. And really difficult. A trick to know is that most of the backplanes that you want to do business with should be completely passive. Some of the last generation of backplanes, like the 6500E that you were talking about, was completely passive except for the electronics that did the clock signaling, which was on the backplane. I know, because I lost a few of them at one site. And you really, really want to, and if you want to replace the backplane, you actually had to take all of the line cards out, disassemble the box to get to the chassis, and inside the chassis to get the backplane out and replace it. It was really a gruesome activity to replace that. And that's why you want a backplane which is completely passive in a chassis, because the only thing that could possibly fail in that then should be mechanical, a crack in the board, somebody put the card in and jammed the pins, which does happen in a chassis. Sometimes people ram the card home too hard. Should never push it home too hard. That's a good point, actually. That's why there are those locking pins on the side. in the old days, we used to lock, push the cards home themselves. Back in the days when linemen used to use very big hammers to put things together, and you'd say, please put a card in, and they'd just shove it in and then really, really slap it.
Oh, a quick aside on that, Greg. Yeah. There are some cards, and vendor unnamed here, I think, to be fair, but there are some cards that come with a little clip on the back of the line card. So you buy this, and it's in a beautiful plastic casing, totally protected, which came in a box, everything. And it's got this little yellow kind of clip at the back of it to protect the pins. Hmm. The problem is that you can take that card and you can put it in the chassis without taking the clip off. So the clip design doesn't prevent insertion into the chassis. You know, I won't say it has happened multiple times to the point where you no longer blame the person putting it into the chassis. Yes, they should have remembered, but forced insertion with a piece of plastic on the back where your pins should go. That doesn't end well.
Yeah, because there's a connector there, right? In fact, those connectors are rocket science. Like some of those connectors have 80 or 90 pins.
Yeah, how much is the line card? You know what I mean? And that's a very hard thing to explain, especially when the pins are on the back plane rather than on the line card. So yeah. the problem there is once you've gone too far, you're into a chassis replacement, and that's the bit where you wished you were on site when you saw the cable cable guys putting those 48, you know, this eight slot, 48 ports per slot, and doing it in such a way that prevents you removing the line cards. Yeah.
Yeah. I know what you mean. Absolutely, I do. Yep.
Yeah, like a couple of bits of trivia there. So, as you say, the connectors are rocket science, because certainly the high-end router lines, you can get, a terabit per line card, shipping now and more in the future. So there's a lot of pins to carry that many bits. So even though they're really finely engineered to have a low insertion force per pin, there were just so many of them to carry that many packets that in aggregate, the force required to seat it is quite large. It's why you get those big handles with the lever force. So because it's not that we want to make it hard, it's just that the laws of physics kind of don't give us any better options. And you probably heard there are short pins on those connectors as well. So that if a line card is starting to be pulled out, then we know before we lose power and connectivity, so that, for example, we can cleanly stop the fabric sending packets that way, or we can minimize the packet loss by getting an early inclination that someone's about to yank the line card out by having a short pin as well as the longer ones.
Oh, right. So I remember with the 6500 card insertions, you wanted somebody who was careful, but not too careful.
Because
if you did it slowly, you would cause a bus reset. I think it was a power reset, and that would reset the whole chassis. This was online insertion removal. Like you're trying to do it with a powered on chassis. So yeah, things have moved on a little bit since then.
Yeah, but no, that's right. I remember that. That was the thing. The other thing, by the way, is even though, as you say, Greg, the ideal is the backplane is entirely passive, there are still cases where that still includes a little bit of active components that are legitimately part of the identity of the chassis. So one example is on high-end routers, you tend to store the MAC addresses on an EEPROM in the chassis rather than the line cards themselves. Because if you think, today, like I say, at the extremes, a very high-end router can do a terabit per slot, well, you can't fit 1,000 SFPs on a router line card faceplate. There's just not enough space. You can't even fit 100 SFP pluses. So there, you're going to need some sort of modular, even if you have all the MACs for those on the silicon, you're not going to use all those ports. So you tend to store a pool of MAC addresses on an EEPROM in the backplane, and then use them as you need them for the virtual interfaces and even the physical ones, because you don't know at the time of manufacture exactly how many line cards, MAC addresses are going to be used per card. So that's a legitimate use where it's in some sense an active component, but a very boring one. But the fate of those MAC addresses is tied to the fate of the chassis. So sticking that on the back plane is kind of an allowable deviation from being purely passive.
Things have changed over time. There was a time when clocks and MAC addresses and there were CPUs on the back planes because distance in these back planes is really, really important. The further the signal travels, the more the signal degrades or gets affected by the environment. When you transmit an electrical signal down a trace on a backplane, it attenuates it. There's loss. But even worse, and again, John's got some blog posts on this, the signal shifts. It's meant to be a perfectly square waveform, but when you push a square waveform signal of turning a voltage from 0 to 5 volts or 0 to 3 volts, it distorts slightly in time, and as it propagates down the electrical signal, the signal starts to stop being square and the other end has to recover it. The further it goes, the less square the signal looks, and so the thing at the other end doesn't detect a transition from up 0 to 1 or whatever it is. They're usually using coding mechanisms. There's a whole bunch of stuff in here that's not worth talking about, but the further a bus is, the slower it has to be, or the higher quality the signaling has to be, or all of the things above to make a bus work. So when they told me that the Nexus 7018, for example, or the Huawei cloud switch, which has 22 slots in it, I'm just sitting there thinking, how do they make the bus that long? That's almost 1.4 meters of bus from the central CPU module down to the bottom line card. They must be using like advanced magic to carry that signal down that backplane.
Yeah, as I say, it's a surprising amount of physical engineering into making the physical object of the printed circuit board actually as nice an environment as possible. And then, yeah, you do spend a lot of transistors at the sending end encoding it nicely, not being too abrupt in how quickly jump from 1 to 0, and then at the receiving end kind of taking the mush you get back and recovering actually the real ones and zeros out of it. Yeah, you spend quite a lot of transistors doing that.
Okay, so we've got a chassis, we've got our line card slopped home, the line cards are talking to the backplane and transmitting electrical signals to all the other line cards. They might be talking, usually they're talking through in the old days, so back in the previous generations of switches, like the 6500s and the other generation of that sort of generation, they had a centralized switch fabric in the core, a crossbar on the supervisor module. So the supervisor itself would have a chip on it, which is a crossbar fabric, that would connect all of the line cards. So the line cards would send everything down to the crossbar would send everything back to the other line card. In the modern switches, we have these multi-stage fabrics, which is where there are multiple crossbar switch chips in a separate part of the switch. So all of the fabrics, all of the line cards talk down to that. So John, you've done quite a bit in this area, I think, haven't you?
Yeah, I guess, I've looked at a few different platforms that have this architecture now, and you think it gets harder the more different platforms you look at, but it actually starts to make a little bit more sense the more platforms you're exposed to, because you're seeing the same patterns again and again. The common thing is to have on your line card to have a fabric interface chip, probably multiple fabric interface chips, and those guys connect to normally two or more fabric ASICs. So these are ASICs or switching components sitting on the fabric line card or the fabric card. So basically what you have is you have a multitude of choices leaving your line card as to which fabric module you want to send that packet, or as Simon said earlier, maybe it might have been cellified, like Juniper would call it a J cell, or a smaller unit. You take your packet, divide it up, or you take a packet and you aggregate it with other packets going to the same destination. But whatever unit you have of data, you're going to try and spray that or spread it across the multiple fabric ASICs that you can see. So again, those guys would be your interface, your line card fabric ASIC would be connected across the passive backplane to a number of fabric chips which are sitting on your fabric card, and their job is to distribute your packet or your frame or your cell, etc., to the other line cards. So you have effectively a second tier of ASICs that are just responsible for switching your cell, frame, packet to the other line cards. The funny thing about this is that, when Clause networks came along and people are looking at, hey, look at you've got this very broad spectrum of tier two devices. So imagine we're back to a pizza box style network, and we've got tier one boxes which interface with our hosts, our servers, etc. And then we have these tier two switches, and very densely connected, and all they're responsible for is shifting packets between the tier ones. Well, that Clause network is just
an externalized version of your fabric in a large chassis switch. It's the large chassis switch takes care of many, many things for you, like cabling, complexity, et cetera, et cetera. But effectively, line card to a modern line card to a modern fabric is a clause network in your chassis.
Yeah. So there's a couple of different, so just to talk about products at this point, there's several different Cosper chassis designs. There's the Brocade VDX 8700 series, which has multiple slots in the back that you can put fabrics in, so they do that. There's the Nexus 7700. I'm not sure of what the Nexus 9000 does, whether it does this or not.
We'll talk about that one later, actually. That's quite a special case, the Nexus 9K.
Okay. I haven't seen any hardware documents on that yet, so I'm not sure what happens inside there. The Huawei Cloud Engine 12000 series and 9000 series does this, and they're the main ones that I know about. In the Juniper, they don't do the big chassis, but they have the Q fabric. And what they do is they actually take the crossbars and put them into a separate box, which is a chassis, but it's basically full of these fabrics. And then they use fiber optic cables to connect to QUFX 3500s at the top of every rack, and they look like line cards. That Q fabric design is, I call it an exploded chassis. So instead of having a backplane inside the box to communicate between all the line cards, Q fabric kind of says, well, I'll put the fabrics over here in a box and then connect, and the line cards will all be out in the top of rack. It's a very interesting design. Sort of turns the whole network into one single chassis, even though it's made of different things. Instead of connecting the line cards to a chassis, they just explode it out. Interesting design if you want to go and look at it.
Yeah, and just to say, at the very high end of the core routers, there's a class there where, again, for 10 years, there's been a class of multi-chassis routers where you could get any full rack chassis full of 16 line cards, but you could get 5, 6, 7, 8, 10, 12, architecturally many more of them, and they're all connected together in a single cloche fabric. So it looks like a single router you can tell it into, and from a routing protocol perspective, but it actually could fill quite a significant segment of your data center. And any port on any line card is as close to any other port on any other line card in this whole huge system, because they're all connected over this single cloche fabric.
Can I jump sideways for a minute? You said the word cloche, and most people say closs, because it's actually spelled C-L-O-S. Is there actually an umlaut on top of that? Is that?
Oh, well, I'm actually kind of rocked. So there were two. So this comes from research, I think, in the 1950s, done for, I think it was AT&T or the Bell Labs, on how you scale telephone switches. And so the basic idea is, if you've got a unit of switching that's constrained, how do you compose them together to get one really big switch? And they were thinking about phone calls, but the same concept applies to packets or inside a router or inside your entire data center. And there were two guys, well, one was called Banesh, and I think that S is a sh, and the other one was Kloss, and I think he was actually French. So I tend to probably mispronounce him Kloss, thinking of Banesh. I think probably technically he should be Klo, but nobody says Klo. So
I just wondered if there was something I was missing here, because I've always seen it. Most people would not have known that cloche, I think cloche is actually the correct word, because as you say, Charles Kloss, who is a French person, talks about it. I'll put a link to the Wikipedia article. I hope you got your math head on when you see it, because it is math. But it might be cloche. I know a lot of people say cloche. You know, anybody who's only ever seen the word written down as C-L-O-S might never know that it's actually cloche, not closs. Anyway, that's just jumping topics. So those high-end routers that you're talking about now, I know those to be the CRS family of routers from Cisco, for example. Mm-hmm. Does the Juniper MXs do something similar?
So the MX do use a kind of fabric John was just talking about within the chassis, but they're only single chassis. Yeah. The Juniper T-Series high-end routers, I believe, are multi-chassis capable architecturally, at least. I'm not sure if anyone, or if they're widely deployed, but I think they're architecturally intended to be able to do that.
Right, this idea of take multiple chassis and bond them together into one single unit.
Yeah.
Using this type of networking capability. Yeah. Okay, so the next stage of these cloth fabrics are sometimes referred to as multi-stage fabrics. Why do we say that? Is because the line cards is the first stage, and then the crossbars at the back, there's multiples of those, and that's a stage two or a two-stage cloth network. You can have multi-stage cloth networks. You don't normally see those in chassis, but they're usually used in ECMP networking designs. we're not talking about that here today.
Although the Multichassis routers do use a three-stage topology to do that. So.
All right.
Yeah, that's how they go multi-chassis.
All right, that's how the bigger routers do this bonding together, by using three-stage cloth designs.
Yeah, exactly.
Ah, that makes sense. I always wondered how they did it, but I've never been working on those routers, so I've never studied up on how they work.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of amazing, because as John said, they're separated out into multiple parallel planes, so individual packets get sprayed across the plane. So in theory, any one plane can fail or be upgraded without interfering with the actual packet throughput. And so you could start out with a single chassis core router and then sit there while it's forwarding traffic in service and plane by plane change all the wiring so it goes to be a two chassis or more router. And there are actually people who have done this on a Friday night while carrying traffic for their customers, just using the instructions downloaded from the website, and it did work, which I found astonishing.
But why Friday night? Don't do anything on a Friday.
Do these people not have lives?
This was a night where his girlfriend was out. He had nothing better to do, so he thought, well.
Oh, right, yeah. That you only make that mistake once. Yeah. You only do something on a Friday night once.
Yeah.
You either survive it and learn your lesson, or you don't survive it and you never do it again either. You don't have a job afterwards. That seems very weird to me. I really do. Okay, so to pick up there, now one of the most important parts is if you've got a fabric down the bottom there, especially in the old days, in the previous generation of chassis, not old days, but previous generation of chassis, where everything went down to the switch fabric, and usually there was an active switch fabric and a redundant one. In a multi-stage fabric or a cloth-type fabric, you can have one, two, three, four, five crossbars in the back, and if one fails, then you take one offline. A couple of things about that is define failure. So if you're thinking of a five crossbar fabric chips in the back and one of them goes a little bit flaky, how do you detect that and take it out of the pathway, Simon? That's really hard, right?
Yeah, so you need good embedded OAM, essentially. I was saying earlier, a totally failed link is easy to spot and easy to handle. If something's starting to degrade, then you really don't want to have to deal with that. So yes, you need all the fabric chips spend quite a lot of the design time is spent making sure they're talking to each other enough so that any problems in any individual link get spotted quickly, and then you react and take that out of service.
So how much time do you spend detecting that sort of thing?
Fabric chips these days are actually really quite complicated bits of silicon in their own right, because you have to do that, and so you have to manage the topology and in some sense the ECMP. Also, pretty much anything that is a pain at the network level becomes a pain at the fabric level, because that problem is sort of miniaturized inside the box. So all the things people hate, like multicast or QoS or MTUs, they're all problems of the fabric you have to spend quite a lot of time thinking about. I mean, for example, multicast, some fabrics are multicast aware. So if a packet is multicast, it arrives on one line card, it needs sending out to, say, five line cards that are have at least one interface in the multicast forwarding FANAC group. For some multicast, that's just built in. As the packet goes through each of the stages of the forwarding, it gets replicated from some minimal distribution tree, and out it goes. So obviously that's great. That's kind of maximally efficient, but you need extra intelligence in silicon to do that. For other ones, they don't try to do that. Instead, you do a kind of binary replication from line card to line card, which means the fabric can be simpler, but you get this kind of greater latency as you go down this sort of binary replication bit by bit.
That's why you had a variation in competency in switches around multicut capability.
Right.
Or even line cards, because sometimes the line cards had to do the replication, either post or pre, and some line cards did it well and some line cards didn't do it so well. And that's why you get a tremendous variation. Yeah.
Yeah, and there was necessarily a point of queuing from the line card into the fabric as a system, because, say, the whole notion is the line card knows it could send a packet to multiple different line cards at once. The fabric will choose the best one to get overall throughput. So there's necessarily buffering. So that means you have a perfect opportunity to wreck your QoS at that point, unless you're really careful.
Okay, so let's talk about buffering, because buffering inside the chassis is absolutely vital. We talked last week about, in the previous shows, about buffering on input to the PHY, buffering on output from the PHY. It has to cross the line card. There's a couple of buffers in there. And then once it gets to the back plane to go down to the fabrics, it's also got a buffer there as it gets into the fabric. So the fabric itself or the fabric chip has its own arbitration, because it can't. If line card 1 is talking to line card 9, and also 2, 3, and 4 all want to send data to line card 9, you've got a problem there where that's output blocking. That is, the fabric chips can't keep transmitting to line card 9 because all the other cards are trying to talk there at the same time. So there has to be some arbitration around what's allowed to talk, what's not allowed to talk, how long do things sit in queues, who should go next, that type of stuff. Now, I'm not sure if we can do this in an audio where we talk about head of line blocking, virtual output queuing, you know, pushback, distortion, muffer mechanism. Can we do that, Simon, do you think?
We could maybe do the simplest thing, which is probably virtual output queuing. So I guess here the notion is, the analogy, unfortunately, is country dependent. If you're in the UK and you drive on the left, then the example would be a right-hand turning lane. And if you're in a country where you drive on the right, the analogy would be the left-hand turning lane. The idea is you've got traffic that's going to multiple destinations that's come into the line card and is headed into the fabric system. And some of it might have to be held up because of the, you know, it's not ready to send to that line card. But other traffic could be good to go to another line card that is ready to take it. And so it's really important that you queue independently for each destination so that if one queue is held up, you can still keep packets going on the others, and in particular, you don't impact the high priority traffic. You can get all kinds of nasty things happening there. Mm-hmm. But to do that, it's not the case that statically, if you say I have 8 line cards, 1/8 of the packets are always going to each line card. You normally expect a non-uniform distribution. So it's important that you share your buffer memory across all these, which is why they're virtual output queues. You kind of have 8 logical queues, but you want to stat max the buffer memory across all those destinations.
And this is where you get input blocking and head of line blocking and output blocking, because if you don't do these sorts of things. Now, I think it's probably worth drawing out that, you know, again, at 10 gigabits per second or 40 gigabits per second or at 100 gigabits per second, you're talking nanoseconds of intervals between these decisions that are being made.
Yes, very much so. The fabric scheduler is making decisions really quickly. So it can only use kind of fairly approximate heuristics. But as I say, luckily, there are so many of those per second that even a kind of statistical heuristic of fairness will very quickly map out to being actually fair in real use. Mm. So it doesn't have to have a long history. For example, has it been unfair to line card 2 for the last 10 sessions to be nice with now?
It's not like an x86 where you can go, hang on, just everybody hold on while I think.
That's right.
Because as soon as you do that, the latency of pausing is actually making the situation worse. It's faster to just clear the buffer.
Exactly. But the nice thing about the fabric is, again, because it's such a strictly controlled operation, it's very amenable to hardware pipelining. So if you're imagining, you know, roughly these different stages of the line card announcing who it can send packets to centrally, the central scheduler making a decision, the scheduler sending out the decision to the line cards and setting up the internal plumbing, and then those packets actually going across. All those 4 stages can be pipelined, so it can be actively doing one stage while preparing for the other 3, for the next packets 3 down.
We still have speed up, though, as well, Simon, right? We have this concept of making decisions a little bit faster than the per packet rate or the cell rate. So we switch across the fabric a bit faster. We have more decisions per second, maybe, than we have packets arriving per second. So we get to switch the frame across the fabric or have more opportunities to do it if we make a bad kind of decision and increase the efficiency of the backplane of the fabric. So we're allowing ourselves a little bit of a get out of jail free card there. I think there's limits, right? There's limits on how much speed up you can apply and still get benefit from. But I think that's kind of a cool concept there. We just go, well, let's just make decisions a little bit faster. We've got a bit more overhead here and a bit more of a chance of getting the fabric fully utilized.
Yeah, speed up's really important with these multi-stage fabrics because it's no longer the case that one point knows exactly what's going on and that it's exactly right. So yeah, so speed up normally will be the ratio of input bandwidth to a card from the fabric versus the output bandwidth from a card into the fabric. So, you know, if we say have, let's say, a 100 gig line card, it might be able to pour 100 gig into the fabric, but could receive 200 gig or 300 gig out the fabric. And as you say, that's a great get out of jail card. So, for example, if, you know, 2 line cards at once want to send a high priority packet to that line card, then fine, they can both do it. And then that line card can sort out, you know, who gets priority. Whereas if not, it's the fabric's problem to make that work, which is a much harder problem to solve.
So, not always the easiest thing to know about, but just to sort of highlight what goes on inside of a chassis, it's not just plug some cables together.
Yeah, and there's an argument actually that even though we tend to think much more about the kind of packet forwarding and how many routes and how fast and things, it's the packet forwarding silicon that we look first at system. The fabric is arguably more of the heart of the system than the packet forwarding silicon, because if you don't like the packet forwarding system in the chassis, you can just upgrade the line card and plug in a new one. But the fabric architecture is what makes it, is what defines it. So in a sense, you have to make extra sure you get the fabric right, because it's easier to upgrade the other bits once that's in place.
Okay. So all of this stuff leads to an argument about blocking and non-blocking. John, explain how that works.
Yeah, I think we've kind of done about a bit of the lead up to it, where we talk about, you know, how to get packets across the fabric. But yeah, I guess when we talk about a fabric here, the general assumption, and it's a bad assumption, is that we're always talking about a non-blocking fabric, that basically every question we ask of the fabric, it will answer positively. Every packet we send it, it will transfer for us. That's a relatively safe assumption for a modern chassis, but everywhere there are limits, and you need to say, you know, non-blocking, absolutely, for every cell size, for every packet size, because we're not, you know, we talked about the decisions and the sheer complexity and speed at which the fabric needs to make those decisions. Is it, so that's bandwidth wise, we can say it's non-blocking, but you say for all packet sizes, is it non-blocking? So the packet per second rate is really, really important. So yeah, you got to say, well, look, vendor X, you're telling me this box can do that, and you're like, yeah, okay, and they'll say, but maybe packets smaller than 256 bytes, then we're not quite non-blocking. And you know, and that may be perfectly fine. You look at your average packet size in your network and your chances of oversubscribing the fabric, and you kind of go, well, maybe that's a fair trade-off. You know, we're getting this awesome box, and here's a limit. But you got to ask those questions. You know, when somebody, I guess the point I'm trying to make is, for the buyer of the chassis, when somebody says non-blocking, ask them to define exactly what they mean by non-blocking. And it's just, maybe I'm a little bit skeptical. I don't know. But I guess, you know, somebody uses a term like that, and you say, well, what exactly do you mean?
Yeah. Well, there's many places a switch can be blocking. It can be on the line card. It can be on the PHY module that faces towards the 1 gig. So there was line cards for 6500 switches that were oversubscribed on the PHY module, but not on the backplane. There were line cards in the 6500 family has lasted for more than a decade. It just went through all the iterations of the possible combinations. And if you've sort of been working with it, you'll know that there were line cards that were oversubscribed at the PHY module. So they would have 8 1 gig interfaces with 1 PHY, but the PHY module only had 4 gigs into the backplane or up to the next stage of the line card. There were some line cards that were oversubscribed to the bus. There were some line cards that could do full line rate but could oversubscribe the switch fabric down on the supervisor modules. So there's all these different ways of looking for blocking and non-blocking. And you kind of got to understand, and ultimately this is the point of this podcast, ultimately it's taken us 3 hours to get here, but is that non-blocking can happen at different stages. You could have backplane blocking, you can have fabric blocking, you can have line card blocking, you can even have more mundane things where the supervisor itself or the processor, the management plane, where the CPU and the memory and the storage engines are, they can run slow and cause blocking in the backplanes in extraordinary circumstances, or usually only in extraordinary circumstances. But so non-blocking is every packet that you put in should come out. There should be no point at inside of the switch architecture and all of the stages that it goes through that the packets can be. There should never be any congestion. Packets should never be dropped in theory. And that's really what you want.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is something that, so I do a lot of interviewing, and you know, sometimes interview a candidate and have a little bit of a focus on hardware, and you know, sometimes people are quite interested in that discussion, but a lot of time people will say, really? I mean, why do you want to talk about hardware? You know, I'm just, you know, I make, you know, I give me the device. I work my CLI magic. Stuff gets done. You know, pay me money. Thank you. And you kind of say, well, look, if you don't, hopefully you're designing to a requirement. If it's one you made up yourself, and you're like, oh, how do you choose a platform without knowing what it's capable of? and the oversubscription of line cards, or even fabric modules, as I discovered recently. You can buy line cards that are completely non-blocking if it has three fabric modules inserted. But if one fails, actually you were already at the limit. You drop back to 75% of fabric throughput. And you're like, wow, okay, I was assuming we were at N plus one redundancy in the fabric, but that was a silly assumption. So I guess the point here, and what we're trying to get the listeners, be interested enough in the hardware to ask these questions about oversubscription, where it happens, if it's okay or not. We're not trying to tar vendors and say, hey guys, this is terrible, because this is pure magic what they can do. It's incredible. But you've got to say, every designer makes trade-offs. You make trade-offs, hardware engineers make trade-offs, and they have to. Otherwise, you have this horrendous beast that costs the earth, and you'd be complaining about that too. I guess what you're trying to do is find out where the trade-offs have taken place. Where are there oversubscription points or not? If there are caveats, do they affect you? And if so, you design around them, or you influence your vendor choice. But blocking, oversubscription, redundancy, all of those are really important things for you to consider.
There's maybe a nice little example we can talk about now with this that illustrates it, which is stacking. So in this problem of you've run out of capacity with one pizza box and you want to get more in a single forwarding device, then in kind of the evolution of networking systems, stacking is a bit like the duckbill platypus. It's never going to be the next new animal kingdom, but it kind of has a noble niche role down the kind of as a side path in the evolutionary tree. Whereas stacking, you say, okay, I've run out of one pizza box worth of switching, but I don't want to go to the expense of a full crossbar fabric and a chassis. What can I do? And maybe I'm happy to accept a large oversubscription ratio because it's just for a campus wiring closet and most of my ports are mostly idle anyway. And so with stacking, there again, you start with a single unit of forwarding silicon that can handle some number of front-facing ports and switch between them. But there you add on a proprietary pair of interfaces to that one forwarding chip that can speak to its peers. So in just a single one IU box, you might have two or three of these forwarding chips, and they just forwarded together in a loop. So the east interface of one chip plugs into the west interface of another, and you just form a circle. And so that way, if a packet comes in on a port for one chip and it needs to be switched out of a port and by another chip, it's just one hop away, either east or west, from that chip to its friend in the same chassis, in the same box. And that can be non-blocking. But if you just open up those interfaces with special interfaces around the back, then you can loop together 2, 3, 4, 5 boxes and get a loop, a daisy chain of maybe 15 of these chips in a long loop. And so there, you still get a single system. You still get any-to-any connectivity. But obviously, the single bandwidth of that interconnect becomes a limit for the system. So it's obviously non-blocking, but actually can be engineered to a cheap price point that can be useful in some circumstances, provided you know what it's doing under the covers and whether or not that meets the needs of that point in the network design.
This comes back to the argument that everybody wants to own a Ferrari, but not too many people do. Everybody wants to build their networks out of single mode fiber because it's the best fiber. You'll be guaranteed to have the least amount of, worrying about distance. But the price of single mode is that you have to have full-on lasers. You can't just use LED lasers to transmit the signal. So these trade-offs are the things that we make all the way from, the types of lasers that we use to transmit our signals down a fiber optic cable, or 10 gig E needs Cat 6 cable to be able to drive the signal reliably over 100 meters because the IEEE was a bunch of idiots and should have only specified it at 30 meters. These types of things. These are all trade-offs, and you should understand something about them. Or we all think it's important that you should spend some time learning about them. The information that you need is out there. It's not hidden away. It's just not commonly looked at because most people see the CLI and they don't imagine what's happening behind the CLI. If I could encourage you to start spending more time thinking about what happens behind the CLI. When you type this, what actually happens to the silicon? What does the software do to program the silicon to forward this packet through the box that you're using? And this applies for anything, not just chassis-based switches or Ethernet switches, routers, servers. It's going to get much more complicated in the years ahead, because I was just looking at a thing today. One of the Red Hat engineers was giving a presentation at the Red Hat conference, and he's doing 40 gigabit per second forwarding in an x86 platform. and he's got the data to back up. He's showing it, just take Red Hat, run this VXLAN, and he's running a 40 gigabit per second VTEP, albeit at 1,000K packets and above, so it's not exactly perfect. He's a little bit big with the claims, but, you know, 64-bit, at 64-byte frame size, he's getting 7 gigabits per second VTEP performance, which is quite astonishing in an x86 platform. You need to understand blocking, not just in terms of the chassis and the boxes. You need to understand it in terms of routers, you know, traditional routers that are out there in your branches, but also in your x86s in the data center, because that's going to become more important. So there's one last topic we should hit, and that's buses. Now, inside of a chassis, there are many buses. The backplane is a bus, if you look at it correctly, but there's a whole bunch of other buses as well. So, John, you put this stuff in here about the different buses. So why don't we just briefly cover them off so people can think about the different buses inside of our hardware?
Okay. Well, some of them we've talked about a little bit before. So there's SFI, XFI, and Zowie. That's Zowie's XAUI. These are interfaces between, I guess they're logical, well, they're interfaces between transceiver modules and either the main ASIC or the switching ASIC, or somewhere in the path there might be a signal conditioning unit, a PHY or a separate PHY unit. And these are buses, they're called buses. If you have a very dense, say SFI is for SFP plus 10 gig interfaces, XFI is the equivalent for an XFP, which is a slightly older, more mature generation 10 gig interface. You have these interfaces, you have them in your chassis, it could be a pizza box unit. If you just imagine the density that you have, imagine you had a 96 port 10 gig switch, which is, you know, on a single, maybe 2RU or maybe 1RU size. Just imagine the density of traces just to get those 10 gig interfaces to your main ASIC. Now, you might have, for each of those, you might have a 4-port signaling conditioning unit. So you're not going to see 96 other signal conditioning chips. You might, but at some point you're going to run out of space.
You're going to run out of power too.
Yeah,
or cooling, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, some of the chips that are there between or along the length of these buses are there to actually extend, because the whatever SFI will allow you maybe 7 or 8, maybe 9 inches of distance between. It's basically a specification for an electrical interface, and basically it'll say, hey, look, you can have 9 inches between your SFP on the front panel, or your cage that holds it, and your ASIC. And you know, guess what, you know, modern devices, if there's a daughter board or there's a mezzanine card, maybe you're not going to get there, you know, so you need to maybe put a signaling conditioning unit to go and extend the range of that. So these are very difficult interfaces to talk about and to really get into on a podcast. I have a few blog posts about them, but you need to know those are buses and those exist. We can talk about them maybe some other time. But the other one that's quite interesting is PCIe. So PCIe, you kind of go, okay, well, we've heard of this before. You know, maybe generation 2 PCIe. And where would that exist on your 1RU box? Surely it belongs to servers. But no, between your ASIC and your CPU. So remember, your ASIC is focusing on packet forwarding. It is not capable of handling the minutiae of protocol handling, system management, any of that sort of stuff. If you have traffic headed for your control plane, your ASIC needs to offload that to the CPU, and a PCIe bus is, a well-defined way of getting traffic to a CPU. So you might have a couple of lanes of PCIe to get 10 gig forwarding from an ASIC to a CPU. Mm. Now that's not a very complex. I guess it's hard to call it a bus. It's almost like a point-to-point bus. So it's not an incredibly complex bus, but it's there. It's in your commodity hardware.
On the bigger systems, that's really important, because obviously there you can speak into quite a large number of chips on, say, one big line card. And also on the bigger systems, you can be talking many, many gigabytes of RAM owned by the forwarding silicon for its own forwarding tables. You're in many, many probably millions of statistics that need uploading from forwarding hardware up to the CPU, you know, whether you want them or not, we need to keep them. And so what you tend to see on the bigger systems is use PCIe to program the ASICs from the CPU and download entries into their forwarding tables into the memory owned by the forwarding ASICs. And we have a separate internal, maybe gigabit Ethernet or even 10 gigi inside the box, where we use both the CPU to CPU communication, but also packets that need to be pumped up from the silicon up to the CPU can go over this internal control Ethernet, and the CPU either has an embedded NIC because it's a Freescale or MIPS power piece, system on a chip, or it's Nexus with a NIC. So you tend to get these two parallel flows from the CPU to all the chips, which is some combination of PCIe and an internal gigi or 10 gigi packet network that you don't see unless you look for it in the diagnostic show commands. But they're both quite critical and they're both quite busy because of all the flow of information flowing both ways between the CPU and the forwarding data plane.
Just worth pointing that out, I think that there are many buses inside of the computer architecture, that is the motherboards or the management plane where the software runs. There's PCI buses, USB buses, serial ports and so forth, and then the buses that are inside the line cards themselves.
There's one thing I wanted to mention, Greg, and it's mainly because I just think it's kind of cool, and it's about the Nexus 9000. Mm-hmm. So we were talking a little bit about fabrics and fabric chips and saying how awesome they were and specialized, and those fabric at the moment don't buffer packets or anything like that, and generally they make decisions based on pre-programmed cell information. They know where once a frame arrives, it becomes pre-addressed with a header, and those fabric cards know where to send that frame. They're making lots. The fabric switching is making very simple decisions. But then the Nexus 9000 is kind of something very cool in that it actually doesn't contain. Well, I'll be careful here. There are some proprietary hardware, but just if we should speak about basic forwarding. What they've taken is for their tier 2 line cards or their fabric cards. So if you call it tier 2, if you're thinking about it from a class perspective, or call it fabric card, is they've taken, so it's the forwarding is all Trident to ASICs. It's primarily a commodity-based hardware platform that they're using, and they're using commodity ASICs. But those ASICs have very limited forwarding tables, and it's really a precious resource that needs to be maintained. And you have to make a decision, like I think we were going to talk about the 3750 or any box with limited forwarding resources. You need to say, well, look, if I have this amount of, say, TCAM, am I going to spend it on layer 2 tables for MAC addresses or VLANs, or IPv6, or am I going to spend it on longest prefix matching for prefix routing? So they have this difficult decision to make. And what Cisco have done is very innovative. They've taken Trident boxes, Trident ASICs, and used those Trident ASICs as both the line card ASIC and multiple of them, and as the fabric ASIC. And they've done very cool things with the way they've divided up the decision making. So if you imagine you've got, like, I don't know, make it simple, you've got 32,000 routes or 32,000 entries in your hardware. They've made the decisions, or basically they've changed it up, so they're basically making some decisions on the line card. So say, for example, if you want to do layer 2, or if you want to look for just basically frame switching, they'll do all of the kind of adjacency lookups or direct lookups, exact match lookups on the line card, and they've adjusted the ASIC and the way the memory is used on that ASIC to be predominantly focused on that. And basically they will put a header on the packet and they will switch it through the tier 2, and the tier 2 adds really very little intelligence. It just goes, hey, look, you've told me what line card to send this to, and I'm going to send it. So that's cool. Okay, that's their use of the Trident for straightforward binary lookups. But then when it comes to routing for longest prefix match, they don't have the resources on the tier 1 line card or on the I/O module. And so what they do is effectively have a default route, and they route the packet to any of the tier 2 line cards. And on the tier two, instead of just cell switching it, it now doesn't have any of that information. It actually takes the routed packet, it looks it up, and on all the tier twos, they've used the memory so well that on the tier twos, they have all of the longest prefix match information. So basically, they've taken this really constrained system and they're saying line cards, you can do, you know, adjacency lookups, and fabric modules, you can do all the routing. So on the tier twos, those guys are now routing. They have all the longest prefix match tables,
right,
and they route the packet out. So a bit of a long-winded explanation there, I feel like.
You might want to go. So what I think I'm hearing is that they're using the available TCAM space on the fabric chip, and they're using the fabric chips in the line cards to do layer two forwarding, but they're using the TCAMs in the Trident chipset in the fabric to do layer three forwarding?
It's all Trident, and basically they're using them in different ways depending on their role. So
yeah.
they take the Trident on the line card and use that for layer two forwarding or you know, exact routes, /32 routes. And they're taking the TCAM on the tier twos and using those guys for longest prefix match routing. So they're distributing the decision making between the line card and the fabric. I guess what I'm trying to say is that they're taking a commodity platform and they're using it in an incredibly innovative way. And
okay.
It is interesting when people talk about commodity being the death of innovation that I think people should have a look at the architecture of the 9K again and just kind of, well, actually, just from a pure nerdiness perspective, it's really cool what they've done.
I think the innovation for commodity is actually in the software. So the Nexus 9000 platform actually has APIs and external programmability and a whole bunch of other things. Because they didn't spend 5 years mucking around with silicon design, they just said, well, this is what we've got. Now let's do something with it.
Moore's Law predicts you would see increasingly more of the sort of things John's talking about. Because we discussed in the first program, you know, it's now so expensive to design a chip because they're so big. It used to be if you didn't like what, you know, what was there on the shelf, you just did your own. And so there was no imperative to do that. They're now so big that so few people are going to be able to design them. That would be much more, okay, this is what we've got. This is what we can take off the shelf. Mm-hmm. How can we build on this to achieve what we want to do? And that could be, like John says, kind of reprogramming in a way that maybe the designers didn't fully intend but works. Mm-hmm. It could be maybe stick on, you know, maybe an FPGA, but still using an off-the-shelf chip for most of the oomph, but just kind of doing some tweaking around the edges. Mm-hmm. But you'll see more, the big chips are increasingly fixed points in design, but there's lots of space to innovate around how exactly you stick them together.
Yeah, and I think we're seeing that as well. So in more simpler things, Juniper with their QFX 5100, 50, that 5000 family, they've actually run the software in 2 KVM images. And you can actually switch between the operating software without touching the forwarding plane. Same silicon, just a different way of running the Junos software so that you can actually boot from one operating system to another on the fly without impacting the forwarding plane. That's innovation to me too. So there's, yeah. All right. Well, I think we'll call it squids there because that's another hour and wow, three shows. Thanks so much, guys. So John, why don't you tell people where they can find you on the internet?
Sure. I'm blogging infrequently. I don't think I've put up a post in quite a while now, but I'm on the networksherpa.com and I'm on Twitter occasionally too at networksherpa.
You do pop up occasionally. And Simon, thanks very much for joining us again this week. I really appreciate your time. Can people find you anywhere exciting?
I tend to spend my days locked in the Under Volcano lab rather than frolicking in the social networks. But I am at Simon Chats on Twitter if people want to get hold of me. Yep.
Thanks very much. And of course, I'm Greg Farrow. You can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com. Thanks so much for listening to the show today. And as always, you can find us on the web at packetpushers.net. Tune in next week when we'll return to having more content. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter as @packetpushers or send us email at packetpushers@gmail.com and let us know what you're thinking. And as always, remember that too much networking would never be enough.